Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for December 7th, 2025, from the Eat section, invited in, a richly spiced chickpea stew becomes a moment of hospitality in a war-torn city. But first, the cover story. The shocking crash that led one county to reckon with the dangers of e-bikes. Unregulated e-bikes are a growing danger on American streets. In one Bay Area town, a terrible accident finally led to reform. This article was written by David Darlington. In September 2023, Amelia Stafford was 15 and beginning her sophomore year at Terra Linda High School in eastern Marin County, California. An honor student who loved reading, played the trumpet, did well at science, and aspired to work for NASA, Amelia often rode her bike to school. Both of her parents, Monica, who works for the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, and Scott, an Emmy-winning composer and a founder of the Poland Music Group, have histories as cyclists. He grew up riding to school in San Francisco, and she commuted to her job on her bicycle across the Golden Gate Bridge. "It was very important to me that my kids grow up learning how to ride bikes," Scott says. "I wanted them to get exercise," Monica adds, "so Amelia's bike didn't have a motor. In the wake of the pandemic, electric bicycles were proliferating. Many of Amelia's classmates had gotten e-bikes, or faster machines now known as e-motos, for birthdays and holidays. On a warm Saturday night after a football game, a group of kids was playing around with one." Coral Belisi, Amelia's best friend, recalls that Amelia got on the bike behind someone and rode up and down the street. She says it was such a short ride that wearing a helmet didn't occur to anyone. "When the bike toppled over, our immediate reaction was that we all started laughing. We just thought it was so funny," she says. "Like, ha ha, they're so stupid, they can't even ride bikes." Then they saw the blood on the pavement around Amelia's head. Coral, who had taken a CPR course, called 911 and told the others not to touch Amelia. Then she ran to the Stafford's house and banged on the door. Monica had gone to bed early. She ran barefoot from the house. When she reached her daughter, Amelia's eyes were open, but they had rolled back and blood was coming out of her ears. EMTs arrived soon after and transported her to Marin Health Medical Center, where a CT scan showed bleeding between the skull and the brain. When doctors removed the right side of Amelia's skull, they found that the damage to blood vessels surrounding her brain was worse than normal for such injuries, and that the resulting blood clot was leading to compression on the brainstem. With considerable difficulty, Blake Taylor, the neurosurgeon who operated on her, stopped the bleeding. The surgery lasted almost until dawn, when Amelia was loaded into a helicopter for transfer to a hospital in Oakland. As he watched the helicopter take off, John Ma, a trauma surgeon on call that night at Marin Health, was distraught. He had been fearing a case like Amelia's for years. As the only trauma facility in Marin County, which sits on the opposite side of the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco and features some of the region's most inviting open space, as well as an affluent and fitness-conscious population, Marin Health has always seen a lot of injured bicyclists. But historically, most of the injuries were minor: broken clavicles, wrists, ribs. That changed in the summer of 2020, when Ma began noticing an increase in bicycle-related deaths. The first was a 72-year-old man who lost control of his bike on a downhill grade and crashed into a guardrail. He broke his ribs in 20 places, punctured a lung, fractured a leg, broke a wrist, suffered a concussion, and, after several months of going back and forth between the hospital and rehab, died of a stroke. More fatalities followed, including a 62-year-old pedestrian who was struck by a bicycle on a multi-use path. When I heard that, I thought, that's really strange, Ma says. I can't remember a case of a pedestrian killed by a pedal bicycle. But the pedestrian hadn't been killed by a pedal bicycle. Like the case of the 72-year-old, an e-bike was involved, a device that Ma says he had never heard of till then. But as we moved from the summer of 2020 into 2021 and 2022, and we kept hearing it reported through the hospital and the media, another e-bike accident, another fatality. At some point, I was like, wait a minute, there's something seriously wrong here. At the time, the county public health department didn't distinguish e-bike crashes from those involving conventional bicycles, but Marin Health maintains a database of trauma cases, so Ma, a soft-spoken 57-year-old surgeon who in his off hours has also waged battles against the tobacco and soda industries, began talking with the medical director of trauma services, Edward Alfrey, who, it turned out, was compiling numbers on injuries associated with e-bikes. As the pandemic continued, the number of e-bike accidents increased. You would expect that, Alfrey says, because sales were skyrocketing. Indeed, in 2022, over 1 million e-bikes were sold in the United States, up from 287,000 in 2019, according to the Light Electric Vehicle Association. But what really struck Alfrey and Ma was that e-bike injuries were far more serious than those sustained on conventional bikes. Ma says they were more like what's seen in motorcycle crashes. A pelvic fracture, for example, was uncommon on a pedal bicycle, only about 6% of conventional cycling injuries. For e-bike crashes, though, it was 25%. The most alarming difference was the fatality rate. On a pedal bike, the chance of dying from an injury is about 0.3%, Alfrey says. On an e-bike, the data indicated it was 11%. These findings signaled what was unfolding around the country. During the same four-year period when nationwide sales quadrupled, e-bike injuries increased by a factor of 10 to 23,493 from 2,215, according to the National Electronic Injury Surveillance System. A study by the University of California, San Francisco, found that from 2017 to 2022, head injuries from e-bike accidents increased 49-fold. As in Marin County, casualties in other parts of the country included e-bike riders themselves and people they ran into. In 2023 in New York City, two pedestrians were killed by e-bikes, and 23 of 30 cycling fatalities were e-bike riders. In South Florida, a 66-year-old woman was killed by a 12-year-old boy on an e-bike, and a 54-year-old man riding a conventional bike died after being hit from behind by a 14-year-old on an e-moto. In Minnesota, a woman permanently lost her sense of taste and smell after being hit on a sidewalk by an e-bike. In San Diego County, the towns of Carlsbad and Encinitas announced public emergencies after a woman and a teenage boy were killed on e-bikes. And in Los Angeles, a 12-year-old girl died after crashing on the back of an e-bike. By the time the helicopter carrying Amelia Stafford was banking away to the east, Ma was out of patience. All of the serious injuries prior to that were in older patients, he says. This was a young person. After the aircraft was out of sight, he called Mary Sackett, a member of the Marin County Board of Supervisors. The day that we were dreading has come, he told Sackett. One of your young constituents is very seriously injured, and her outcome is unknown. This has changed everything. You have to do something. The argument for e-bikes is a compelling one. Because they're so easy and fun to ride, they inspire more people to bike instead of drive, with far-reaching environmental, economic, and health-related benefits. A 2020 study of Portland, Oregon, indicated that if one out of every seven automobile trips was instead made by e-bike, according to the Department of Energy, half of all vehicle trips go less than 3 miles from home, a distance easily traversed by bikes. Carbon emissions would drop by 12%. Bloomberg New Energy Finance calculates that e-bikes are already cutting worldwide demand for oil by 1 million barrels per day, or 4 times as much as all the world's electric cars. And because e-bikes cost only a fraction as much as automobiles, while also significantly reducing the costs associated with parking, fuel, and maintenance, they are now seen by many as the key element of the micromobility movement, defined by low-speed, human and electric-powered transportation. But to achieve this kind of broad societal benefit, e-bikes are likely to need greater regulatory oversight. The government's effectively hands-off approach dates to the turn of the 21st century, when Lee Iacocca, the former Ford and Chrysler executive, founded EV Global Motors, whose flagship product, the e-bike, may have coined the term. That product didn't succeed, but in 2002, it helped bring about HR 727, which provided for the regulation of low-speed electric bicycles under the Consumer Product Safety Act. It also set the maximum speed for such bikes at under 20 miles per hour, a rate that, while fast by conventional biking standards, crucially placed it under the purview of the Consumer Product Safety Commission rather than the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which would have subjected it to the same laws as motor vehicles. As a result, e-bike regulations are similar to those for conventional bicycles, meaning, among many other things, that operating one doesn't require a driver's license. As e-bikes have become more sophisticated, lightweight lithium-ion batteries have replaced heavy lead-acid ones, and computerized motors now provide variable levels of assistance, numerous efforts have been made to classify them. 46 states have adopted some version of a 3-tiered system of e-bike categories that was established a decade ago by People for Bikes, a trade and advocacy organization based in Boulder, Colorado. In Class 1, the bike's motor assists the rider up to a speed of 20 miles per hour, but only when a rider is pedaling. Class 2 has the same top speed, but also has a hand-operated throttle, similar to a motorcycle's, that can be used in lieu of pedaling. Class 3 is like Class 1, but its maximum assisted speed is 28 miles per hour. The federal limit of 20 miles per hour applies to the speed generated solely by a motor. Speeds can exceed that in combination with human pedaling. As a rule, Class 1 bikes are permitted wherever a conventional bicycle can go, including bike lanes and trails, while Class 2 and 3 are restricted to streets and roads, in theory, if not in practice. Class 1 is very similar to the definition of an electric bike in Europe, says Matt Moore, the policy counsel at People for Bikes. The other two types are generally not allowed there. They're treated as mopeds, which require a license, registration, and insurance. E-bike motors in the European Union are usually limited to a maximum speed of 15.5 miles per hour, a pace seldom exceeded by casual conventional cyclists. E-bikes have now become so popular that old-fashioned human-powered ones are tagged as analog or acoustic bikes. The extra boost of energy they provide feels like magic, a perpetual tailwind, a helpful nudge at your back. Without any training or education, however, people accustomed to analog bicycles can be unprepared for the power, acceleration, and speed of e-bikes, not to mention their weight, which typically exceeds 50 pounds, or roughly twice that of conventional bikes. Hence the similarity to motorcycle injuries, thanks to increased momentum and the greater harm from impacts when they get out of control. Since e-bikes were legally defined as distinct from motor vehicles in 2002, apparently only one additional federal law allowing their use on federally funded trails that don't permit motor vehicles has regulated them further. Individual cities and counties, however, have enacted a crazy quilt of local rules. Some states are now considering mandatory licensing, registration, and insurance for e-bikes. When Nashville commissioned a public survey in 2022 on the issue of allowing e-bikes on the city's greenways, there were 2,700 responses. Class 1 pedal assist e-bikes got 54% approval. Class 2 hand throttle bikes got 40%. Universities, including Yale, Fordham, and some California state schools, have banned e-bikes from their campuses. Following the death of the 66-year-old woman in Florida, the village of Key Biscayne outlawed e-bikes altogether. After a deadly collision between an e-bike and a pedestrian, a Boston City Councilman proposed legislation banning mopeds and e-bikes for food delivery. Such a law would constitute the nuclear option in New York City, where food delivery represents ground zero in the e-bike explosion. During the pandemic, when services like DoorDash and Grubhub mushroomed in popularity, delivery workers embraced e-bikes to keep up with demand. At the same time, Citibike, New York's bike share program, expanded the electric bike options in its rental fleet. The resulting swarm of fast machines, frequently driven in law-breaking ways, gave rise to a grassroots nonprofit group called the NYC E-Vehicle Safety Alliance. With more than 1,000 members, including 100 self-identified victims, its demands include the licensing of e-bikes, the goal of a proposed Priscilla's Law named for a 69-year-old educator who was killed by a rented e-bike that ran a red light, the confiscation of e-bikes that violate traffic laws, and their prohibition from public parks. Mayor Eric Adams has responded by imposing an e-bike speed limit of 15 miles per hour, but because so many delivery workers are immigrants, the issue has taken on socio-political overtones. Not wanting to criminalize or deprive the underprivileged of good employment opportunities, Ben Furness, the executive director of the nonprofit bicycle advocacy group Transportation Alternatives, recommends prohibiting the sale of Class 3 e-bikes. He adds that he would also like to see much more regulation of the delivery app ecosystem so that it doesn't pressure workers into breaking the rules to hit their targets, a position shared by Zoran Mamdani, the mayor-elect. In Marin, in response to the casualties there, the Marin Healthcare District Board of Directors passed a resolution in December of 2022. Requesting state and local governments to study further measures to safely regulate electric bikes. When that generated no response, Ma, who is not on the board, reached out to public officials who surprised him, he says, by reporting that the county coroner had no record of any e-bike deaths at all. This turned out to be a labeling issue. Ma might have known that a patient had died from e-bike injuries, but by the time that was recorded by the coroner, cause of death could be accident. Marin officials needed hard numbers to effect a change in public policy. In part, because of this difficulty with the data, the county seemed to be making little progress. But then, Ma says, Amelia Stafford crashed and everything changed. It was like a light switch. Following her surgery in September 2023, Amelia was placed in a medically induced coma. After a week, she was taken off the drugs, at which point her parents, Scott and Monica, expected her state to be somewhere between stupor and vegetative. On the day her breathing tube was removed, they say they were told that if she was going to be able to speak again, it might happen by that evening. They went out for a walk, leaving Scott's brother by Amelia's bedside. All of a sudden, Scott remembers, we got a text saying, she's talking a lot. Over the next several days, Amelia slowly regained some mobility. A bacterial infection in her brain resulted in two more high-risk surgeries, but by November, she was allowed to return home, wearing a helmet when not in bed, and in late February, her skull was restored with a replica of its missing fragment. Gradually, her speech, vision, hearing, and memory returned to near normal, along with her ability to read and write. Monica describes this outcome as more amazing than we can express. Talking about her crash today, Amelia calls the term e-bike a play on words. If the machines were called motorbikes, she believes they would be far less popular. But the fact that it's called an e-bike, evoking such everyday stuff as email, e-books, or, less salubriously, e-cigarettes, makes it accessible. Her friend Coral concurs. People don't think about them as mini motorcycles, which is really what they are, she says. People think of them as bikes plus, just like a little extra. It's really geared toward younger people who don't have an understanding of the impacts. Bikes have always offered independence to kids and liberated parents from ferrying them around. But the fun factor offered by e-bikes mixes dangerously with young people's proclivity for play, made worse because they are often not old enough to drive and don't know the rules of the road. The Marin chapter of Safe Routes to School, a national organization that encourages kids to walk and bicycle, has been teaching e-bike safety since 2022, and Marin has also introduced an online e-bikers club to educate kids about rules and etiquette. But Matt Willis, a former public health director for Marin County, says he heard complaints that kids were ignoring stop signs, weaving in and out of traffic, riding double and doing wheelies down the middle of Sir Francis Drake Boulevard, which is Marin's main thoroughfare. There were, he adds, reports of pedestrians being knocked over by e-bike gangs. Even some of the country's biggest e-bike boosters began to understand that something was out of order. One such person was Bob Mittelstadt, a retired trial lawyer who bicycles several days a week on Marin's Mount Tamalpais, the reputed birthplace of mountain biking. Until a few years ago, he pedaled an analog bike, but as he approached his 70s, he felt increasingly limited, riding shorter and shorter distances over the same routes every day. Then a friend started regaling him with stories about how far he could ride on his e-bike. So I took his for a test ride and never looked back, he says. Mittelstadt, now a lean and energetic 77, and some fellow senior cyclists formed a nonprofit organization called E-Bike Access to advocate electric mountain bikes on Mount Tam. Mittelstadt says that many of the arguments against e-mountain bikes are the same ones originally used against conventional bicycles, that they cause erosion and scare wildlife and hikers. But then they'll usually say, e-bikes are even worse, and even if you just allow the legitimate class ones, the next wave is going to be kids on their throttle devices. By throttle devices, he is referring to Class 2 machines, which have captured an estimated 2/3 of the e-bike market. According to People for Bikes, the rationale in 2015 for creating a class for bikes with throttles, which can eliminate even the modest exercise benefits of pedal assistance, was that many e-bikes already had them, and the trade organization didn't want to exclude those products and companies. But to Mittelstadt and others, it's inappropriate to consider these vehicles to be bikes at all. The essence of bicycling is pedaling, Mittelstadt says. A machine propelled by a motorcycle throttle just shouldn't be considered a bicycle. It can go from 0 to 20 faster than a regular bike without any exertion at all. As a volunteer for Safe Routes to School, Mittelstadt inventoried the classes and brands of bicycles and e-bikes at 12 local campuses in Marin County. He found that while a majority were conventional bikes, among electric devices, those with throttles were by far the most popular, and that most of them had motors capable of going faster than 20 miles per hour. To conform with federal law, Class 2 e-bikes have speed controllers that keep users under the limit, but these can be circumvented by magnets, dongles, third-party apps, tuning kits, wire clippers, or even software provided by the manufacturer, unlocking modifications popularly called jailbreaking. You do it by pushing a button or two or entering a code on the display, Mittelstadt says. It's as easy as changing a setting on your iPhone. By most accounts, the company that led this movement was Super 73, an Orange County-based American lifestyle adventure brand founded in 2016. With retro styling, a bench seat, and formidable 4-inch wide tires, its product looked like a mini motorcycle, and it attracted endorsements from the likes of Will Smith, Paris Hilton, and Madonna. Others, like Suran, a Chinese manufacturer, were straight-up dirt bikes that don't fit the regulations at all, says Brett Thurber, an owner of a three-story Bay Area e-bike business called The New Wheel. But kids were asking their parents to buy them because they look cool and go really fast. Some manufacturers, but not governments, have taken it upon themselves to call such machines Class 4 e-bikes. Others refer to them as out-of-class electric vehicles. Bicycle advocacy groups, which want to avoid being associated with these machines, prefer e-motos. In any case, they aren't bicycles, nor are they street legal without registration and a license, yet they still show up regularly on roads and bike paths. One online influencer called Sur Ronster, who also has a retail business called Ronster Rides, posts videos of bands of teenagers, dozens strong, outdoing one another's daredevil feats at breakneck speed on city streets and highways. We all want to get kids out of cars and onto bikes, Mittelstadt says. The manufacturers took advantage of that. If the limit is 20 miles an hour, kids will want to go 21. If the limit is 21, they'll want to go 22. In the old days, when you had loud, gas-powered, smelly mopeds, everybody knew what they were. Today, because the vehicles are electric and quiet, it's hard for the police to detect when they've crossed the line separating e-bike from moped or motorcycle. Some schools in Marin County now prohibit such e-motos from parking on school property. On a weekday afternoon last spring, Mittelstadt toured a few campuses to see how any restrictions were working. "We'll just pull in here and you can see how effective the enforcement is," he said, approaching Tamalpais High School in Mill Valley, where he coaches a mock trial team. The school has cages for kids to lock their bikes during the day, but several Super 73s were parked beside them. Because these are banned, they're not allowed inside the cage, so they just park them outside the cage. Very effective. A few blocks down the road at a water treatment plant adjacent to Mill Valley Middle School, several e-motos were locked to railings in the parking lot, with more at a nearby community center. As the end of the school day approached, idling cars and SUVs formed a line leading into the entrance of the middle school. "This is what we're up against, cars clogging up traffic, waiting to pick up their kids," Mittelstadt says. "But it's a false dichotomy to suggest that the choice is either an electric device or parents bringing them into school. It could be a regular bicycle, or it could be a legal e-bike." When school was done, kids streamed out of the building. Some got on conventional bikes, others mounted electric devices and sped out onto the bike path where a pedestrian was struck and fatally injured by an e-bike in 2022. You can see how they're releasing their energy, Mittelstadt said. They're pent up all day in school, you know, probably not really enjoying most of the topics. They can't wait to get out, and then they get on their bikes, popping wheelies, going 30 miles an hour. They're the big guns on campus now. It's just a great high for them. At a third stop, Redwood High School in nearby Larkspur, several machines, Jaycion, Lectric, Ride One Up, were locked to trees, poles, and fences across from the school. Other e-motos, Movecan, Ridstar, Hofsco, Aerial Rider, were brazenly attached to bike racks in front of the administration office. Aerial Rider is the fastest bike you see on these campuses, Mittelstadt said. They have advertised a top speed over 38 and a motor of 1,000 watts. This one has no class label, so it's illegal for anyone to ride. A spokesman for Aerial Rider says that it no longer makes and sells such a model and that all models are shipped with compliant speed settings, as well as the proper classification and safety labels. Amelia was on an e-moto when she crashed. Coincidentally, in the course of his volunteer work before her accident, Mittelstadt made the acquaintance of Amelia's mother, who was working for a public service organization on Mount Tamalpais. At one point, the two of them staffed a mobile van that provided information about the mountain to visitors. When Amelia's injury became public, Mittelstadt regretted not having acted more quickly in his assessment of throttle bikes. If I had been more forceful, if I had known more, if I had done the research on how dangerous these bikes are and said something to Monica at the time, maybe life would have turned out differently for Amelia. After Amelia's crash, Marin County applied what Mary Sackett, who would go on to become president of the county board in January of this year, calls a full court press. She convened a meeting on e-bike safety with Ma, Alfrey, Willis, Damone Connolly, Marin State Assemblyman, and representatives from law enforcement, education, and safe routes to school. Willis, who had been working with EMS on a system to track e-bike accidents, finally began compiling numbers collected by ambulance crews, which soon showed that the rate of e-bike-related accidents was 9 times higher for youths than for riders over age 20. The rate for 10 to 15-year-olds was 5 times greater than for any other group. The county proceeded to issue a public health advisory recommending that riders not use e-bikes with throttles, and in January 2024, Connolly introduced California Assembly Bill 1778 to prohibit anyone younger than 16 from riding a Class 2 e-bike and to require anyone using those bikes to wear a helmet. The proposed legislation had the potential to set national precedents. Amid the hodgepodge of e-bike laws established locally throughout the United States, most states have an age limit of 16 for Class 3, but none for Class 1 or 2. In those states that have placed restrictions on these classes, the age varies from 14 to 16, but no laws at the time mandated limits specifically for Class 2. The bill encountered resistance from bicycle advocates, loath to stigmatize the machines or discourage people from getting out of cars. A group called Streets for All opposed the legislation, citing an unfair marketplace for consumers who have invested in $1,000 e-bikes for their children, potential for selective and uneven enforcement, decreasing the number of cyclists on the road, thereby making those remaining less safe, and increasing teenagers, who are historically the worst driving demographic by age, reliance on cars, and therefore worsening the already high rate of vehicle collisions in California. Neither the Marin County Bicycle Coalition nor the California Bicycle Coalition, CalBike, took a position on the bill, though CalBike's policy director, Jared Sanchez, asked on the organization's website. In a state where 4,000 people die annually and many more are injured due to traffic violence, some California cities are freaking out because teenagers on e-bikes did a wheelie? Cycling advocacy organizations generally subscribe to the view advanced by Ben Furness of Transportation Alternatives. The focus, he says, should be on the vehicles that are killing and maiming the most people, heavy cars and trucks. Instead of increased regulation of e-bikes, the solution should be infrastructure that allows safe places for everyone, specifically protected bicycle lanes wide enough for both slower and faster bikes. The most egregious examples of the latter, out of class e-motos, are what e-bike supporters argue should be the target for policing, not unmodified class 2 bikes. For 100 years, we just had cars and pedestrians, says Asha Weinstein Agrawal, the lead author of a forthcoming paper on e-bike safety and policy options in California for the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Motorcycles were regulated like cars, but Americans treat bicycles as toys. In other words, bikes were an afterthought, not carefully integrated into the designs and rules of our roads, which Agrawal says is much more of a problem now that we have electric bicycles on the road as well. While she agrees that it would be good to get people to switch from gas vehicles to e-bikes, she says, it doesn't make sense to have an ever-growing number of different categories with separate rules. She has found that most people don't understand the three-class system. Not surprisingly, she adds, people are unlikely to follow rules they don't understand. The most consequential resistance to California Assembly Bill 1778 came from the State Assembly's Transportation Committee, whose principal consultant concluded that Marin's injury data wasn't sufficiently persuasive to justify a statewide law. As a result, the bill was eventually amended to a voluntary 4-year pilot program only in Marin County, with a requirement to report enforcement data by January 1, 2028. It still had to make its way through the state Senate, however, a challenge for which the star witness was Amelia Stafford. In May 2024, John Ma, who had been following both Amelia's progress and that of AB 1778, asked the Staffords if she could testify before the state legislature. At first they said no, believing that Amelia had already been through a sufficient ordeal. But when she heard about the opportunity, she surprised us, Monica says. She said she wanted to do it. On the Tuesday after Memorial Day, Amelia traveled to Sacramento with her family and her friend Coral. After thanking 5 teams at 5 hospitals for enabling her to be there, she told the Senate's Transportation Committee that her accident showed how devastating a fall from a Class 2 e-bike can be. To a teenager, she said, these bikes seem like normal bikes. 20 miles per hour doesn't faze us. It doesn't sound fast or dangerous, but the reality is far different. Echoing the findings by Ma, Alfrey and other surgeons around the country, she testified that falls from e-bikes are more like violent falls from motorcycles. Because of what I've learned, she said, I'm here to speak out to protect teenagers like me. The bill passed the legislature in late August. On September 27th, days before the year's deadline for enacting new laws, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill that requires e-bike batteries to be certified by an accredited testing laboratory. The following day, he signed a bill resembling Marin's, establishing a voluntary pilot program in San Diego County, but restricting e-bike ridership to age 12 or older for both Class 1 and Class 2 machines. Then on September 29th, Newsom, who has a house in Marin, showed up at the Staffords for an impromptu signing ceremony. I saw 2 signature lines, and I thought one of them was for me, Amelia says. I reached for his pen, and he very politely took it away from me. It was one of the most humiliating things in my life. Amelia's life would seem to warrant the opposite of embarrassment. After missing her sophomore year of high school, she returned in the fall of 2024 and is now a senior planning to go to college. She volunteers as a peer mentor at Kaiser Foundation Rehabilitation Center in Vallejo, California, and she and Coral started a First Responders Club at Terra Linda High School, teaching students how to react in an emergency. The seizures she has as a result of her injury, together with the rest of her experiences over the past 2 years, have altered her future plans. Instead of hoping to work for NASA, she now wants to study neuroscience. Two more California laws now prohibit the sale of apps that modify e-bikes to increase their speed beyond the legal limit, as well as the sale of devices that enable such modification. As a result, Super 73's website now states that customers who downloaded the Super 73 app after January 1, 2025, would not be able to modify its bikes beyond the Class 2 mode in which they're sold. But a customer service representative for the company acknowledged by email that the motor itself is capable of higher speeds and other configurations. The Marin law went into effect at varying points around the county this summer, and after grace periods, jurisdictions have begun enforcing it, but only after riders have been stopped for another infraction, like running a red light. The police are not supposed to stop anyone based on appearance, for example, their apparent age. Moreover, during a recent municipal meeting, one officer explained that when they try to pull juveniles over, the kids often flee, evading pursuing police cars via narrow trails and sidewalks. But he also noted that in one case, at least, the parents of a child who was injured while riding an e-moto were cited for allowing an unlicensed juvenile to operate a motorcycle. In any case, the new law doesn't seem to have diminished enthusiasm for what in some cases are illegal bikes. This September, at Redwood High School, where Mittelstadt counted 31 e-motos in April 2024, he now counted 48. David Darlington, who wrote this article, is a lifelong cyclist who has received a National Magazine Award for Public Interest for a previous article on traffic laws and bike safety. I would now like to just take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now from the Eat section of the New York Times Magazine, a rich chickpea stew that tastes like an oasis. A writer in Afghanistan finds momentary peace in Talaand e-Nakhod. This article was written by Eric Kim. On a snowy night 20 winters ago, Michael Sheikh stood outside his friend Tamim's house in downtown Kabul, Afghanistan, waiting to be let in. Tamim had invited Michael over for dinner. The two-story home had a large front yard and a 10-foot wall that separated the public dirt road from the peaceful residence, where inside a half-dozen guests were already mingling over cocktails and wine, while Tamim was in the kitchen. It was an intentional oasis in the middle of a chaotic Kabul, Michael said, recalling how even though a bombing had rattled the city earlier that day, the snow had brought with it momentary peace. Eating, too, brought with it momentary peace. Working as a human rights investigator at the time, documenting war crimes in Afghanistan, and interviewing victims of violence, Michael found that most of his sources served him a meal as part of the meeting, showcasing the hospitality of Afghan culture. There's an old Afghan saying, "You can tell a man's generosity by the length of his tablecloth." Even the Taliban, which held him briefly at one point, fed him Kabuli pilaw, a spiced lamb and rice dish topped with carrots, raisins, and nuts. There's something about food that can make Talking about tragedy, a little less painful, Michael writes in his debut book, The Last Sweet Bite, Stories and Recipes of Culinary Heritage Lost and Found. Food was a skeleton key of sorts, he discovered, expanding lines of communication and capable of disarming both host and a guest. Inside Tamim's house, it was an unfamiliar dish of golden stewed chickpeas with sour yogurt that disarmed Michael the most, not just because it was delicious, but because it made him ask the question, why haven't I heard of this stew before? Called Salant-e-Nakhod, also known as Kurma or Korma-e-Nakhod, it's a dish some Afghan families have forgotten, Tamim told Michael. It was in that moment when Michael saw how war can decimate food cultures and erase recipes, and how continuing to cook and eat those dishes is, as he writes in the book, a small but crucial act of culinary restoration and resistance. Many cultures have a richly spiced chickpea stew thickened with tangy yogurt, and this one belongs in that glorious pantheon right alongside the others. When Michael said to me one day, you need to grate way more garlic into the yogurt than you think. I liked the idea that he was passing Tamim's recipe on to me, as in a game of telephone, but in this case, each receiver of the gift is extra careful with the delivery of the message. Like most stews or kurmis, this recipe benefits from a longer cook time, the kind you get from lingering but not hovering. A typically finished kurma has no extra liquid in it. Afghan stews are thickened by onion gravy once the liquid evaporates, Zarguna S. Adel writes in her book, The Best of Afghan Cooking. This key point, to cook the liquid until it nearly evaporates, until the onions become the gravy, changed my stew game for life. Michael said to me recently in a voice note, you get to know someone better when you eat and drink with them. I thought of this the other day when I took a G train to South Brooklyn, then walked 20 more minutes to meet my friend Josh, a chef at the Afghan restaurant Dunya Kebab House. He had a novel sticking out of his jacket pocket, and so did I, which meant the commute was long for both of us. The meal was phenomenal. Comfort food, Josh called it. Fall apart lamb and fat slicked rice. He told me it felt as if we were guests in their home and they were showing us the foods that matter to them. I meet Josh every few months miles away from our homes like this because I know he'll appreciate the momentary peace of a dinner table, including any lessons we might learn from our hosts and each other while lingering there. And now here is the recipe for Salant-e-Nakhod or chickpea yogurt stew, which appears to have received a 5-star rating from the readers who have tried this recipe. This recipe should yield 4 servings. The ingredients: 2 or 3 garlic cloves, 1 cup or 8 ounces of plain full-fat Greek yogurt, salt, 2 tablespoons of vegetable oil, 1 red onion finely chopped, 1 fresh green chili such as Thai or Serrano, finely chopped plus a few whole chilies for serving, 1 tablespoon ground coriander, 1 teaspoon ground cumin, 1 teaspoon ground turmeric, 1 teaspoon freshly ground black pepper, 1 small tomato, very finely chopped. 3 15-ounce cans chickpeas, drained and rinsed. Cilantro for serving. And warmed flatbread or steamed basmati rice for serving. And in regards to those canned chickpeas, it says you can also start from dried chickpeas, often sold as garbanzo beans. The night before, rinse 2 cups dried chickpeas in a large fine mesh sieve under cold running water. Transfer to a large bowl, add fresh water to cover generously and soak overnight. They will expand considerably. When ready to cook, drain and add in step 3, simmering the stew until the chickpeas are tender, at least 1 hour, adding more water as needed to keep them covered. Preparation. Step 1. Finely grate 2 garlic cloves directly into the yogurt in a bowl and season with salt. Stir to combine, then taste, adding the final clove if you want it more garlicky and more salt if needed. Some will be stirred into the final stew at the end, mellowing the garlic slightly. The rest will be served alongside as a condiment. Cover and refrigerate until ready to use. Step 2. In a medium, heavy bottom pan, heat the oil over medium high. When the oil is shimmering, add the onion and chili and cook, stirring often, until the onion is translucent and golden at the edges, about 10 minutes. Add more oil if the pan looks dry. Lower the heat slightly, then stir in the coriander, cumin, turmeric, and black pepper and cook, stirring until sizzling and fragrant, about a minute. Stir in the tomato and 1 teaspoon salt. Step 3. Add the chickpeas and 2 cups of water, or enough just to cover. Bring to a boil, then reduce the heat to medium-low. Cover partially and simmer, stirring occasionally, until the liquid has reduced and thickened, 15 to 20 minutes. It will thicken further once you add the yogurt later. Step 4. Remove from the heat, taste, and add more salt if needed. Stir in 2 tablespoons of the reserved garlic yogurt. Taste and add more yogurt if desired. Serve immediately, topped with the cilantro and alongside the remaining garlic yogurt, flatbread, or rice, and whole chilies to nibble on for extra heat. And now, with the few moments we have remaining, I will read to you from the Ethicist column of the New York Times Magazine. And as always, these ethical dilemmas sent in by readers are responded to by Kwame Anthony Appiah. He has been at the New York Times Magazine's Ethicist columnist since 2015 and teaches philosophy at NYU. My father had an affair while my mother was dying. Should I tell my siblings? My mother died almost 10 years ago, and as heartbreaking as it was, our family was so thankful to have incredible hospice support so she could pass peacefully at home. In the months leading up to her death, my siblings and I were able to spend about half of our time at my parents' house. We lived a few states away. Near the end, we were there all the time. When I traveled there, I did not bring a computer with me and occasionally would use my dad's computer with his permission. One evening, as I opened the laptop, his Gmail screen was up. Without opening any emails, I could see from the text snippets that he was sending intimate emails to another woman, setting up meetings with her and ordering lingerie for her, all while my mom was dying in our living room. Although I know my parents' marriage was none of my business, I have every reason to believe that this was not a relationship my mother was aware of. My mother passed away about 2 weeks later. I have told only my therapist and my past partner about what I saw. I have not told my siblings, nor have I acted in such a way that my father would know. I understand that looking at his email screen was an invasion of his privacy, but it is more certainly not something I can unsee. We were never particularly close, and this information has strained my relationship with him. I have some guilt about not telling my siblings, as well as not making the most of what most likely are the last few years I have with my dad. I had a wonderful relationship with my mother. I miss her dearly and feel vehemently protective of her. Over time and through therapy, the burden of this knowledge has shifted, but has not become lighter. I truthfully feel that if one of my siblings had this knowledge, I would want them to tell me. I have not yet been able to decide in my mind and heart if I will tell my siblings before he passes, after he passes, or ever. Please help. from the ethicist. You stumbled unwittingly on a very narrow slice of your father's private life at a moment of extraordinary strain. The notion of him ordering lingerie for this woman while your mother was in the next room is repellent, and it has understandably lodged in your mind. But you don't know what the relationship amounted to or whether it continued. What you do know is that he didn't end up with this person. A decade after your mother's death, the question is what to do for the living. You can't do anything for your mother. You can, however, spare your siblings unnecessary distress. You say you'd want to know if they were in your position. But wanting to know isn't the same as having a right to know, and it's not the same as being better off knowing. Unless there's some family decision that would properly turn on this knowledge, telling them risks spreading your pain without purpose. I recognize that families sometimes grow closer after the airing of difficult truths, and that if your siblings were to respond not with shock or recrimination, but with compassion and equipoise, telling them might help you feel less alone. Your feelings matter, but they aren't all that matters, and there may be other ways of healing. What about speaking with your father? You might tell him what you saw, let him know that it still troubles you. He may or may not have an explanation or, anyway, a story that complicates the one you've told yourself. The philosopher Margaret Urban Walker once wrote, "With considered simplicity, that without knowing other people's stories, I really cannot know how it is with others towards whom I will act." That you were close to your mother and not to your father may make you especially inclined to see this as a simple matter of betrayal. But it's far from clear that telling your siblings really would bring anyone closer to peace. Keeping your own counsel in this case might be better described as merciful than as evasive. Thank you so very much for joining me for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again next week for the New York Times Magazine program.